We're coming to our last week on air with some of our favourite shows of the year. It has been just a fantastic year, hasn't it, my friend?
It's been sheer hell, Sarah. No, the truth is we had a wonderful time. We talked to some of the world's most fascinating people. You and I went on this national tour, which was wonderful. We did live events at writers' festivals in Adelaide and Melbourne and Brisbane. I don't know who I am and what I do anymore, Sarah. But this is the first time we've taken the show on tour this year. We went right around Australia. And how was that experience for you, dear Sarah?
From dancing on the tables in Brisbane to doing the show Under the Stars in Darwin, we did see a lot of the country and met a lot of wonderful listeners. And really, we got to spend a lot of time in each other's company.
That's right. And you still like me, don't you? Do you still like me, Sarah?
I think I like you more. Overall, I like you more.
We've got one last week of our favourite shows for the year. And we're going to begin with your amazing conversation you had with artist Vincent Fantuzzo.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Vincent Fantuzzo is one of Australia's most successful portrait artists. It was a painting of his friend Heath Ledger that first brought Vincent to national attention. The portrait went on show in the Archibald in 2008, just after Heath died, and won the People's Choice Award that year. Vincent has now won the People's Choice Award at the Archibald more times than any other artist. He's also won the Moran National Portrait Prize twice, once with a painting of his friend, the filmmaker Baz Luhrmann, and once with a painting of his wife, the actress Asha Keddie. Vince's commissioned portraits include Julia Gillard and Hugh Jackman. All of this success is a long way from Vincent's upbringing in Broadmeadows in Melbourne's north, where it seemed much more likely that he would end up in jail or dead. And Vincent carries the scars of that survival into the big, beautiful life he's built for himself. His memoir is called Unveiled. Hi, Vincent.
Hello.
Where do you start when you're painting a portrait?
I try not to overthink the process of painting, and with my dyslexia, every painting, I don't have someone sit in front of me like a traditional portrait. What I like to do is spend time with the person, get to know them. For me, it's developing trust, talking to the people they know, seeing them in different environments, at work, at home, at a bar.
Julia Gillard?
Yes, at a bar, yeah. We went clubbing. I really did. Yeah, I got to sit not the bar. I got to see a very different side. When someone's out of the workspace also makes me think of, I painted the first female Chief Justice. Seeing her at home with her family was a very different person. And when she walked into the courtrooms, whatever, the building, she had to demand presence. And it wasn't manipulative, but I just saw the switch go and it was just fascinating. And it's like the room, the hallways divided as she walked through. It was so powerful.
Some of your paintings, or a lot of them, are really on this huge scale. Do you sketch out a portrait first, or how do you go about it?
When it comes to faces in particular, I find it comes very naturally. Strangely, I have a facial recognition problem, but I find it, you know, there's not a lot of things that I'm good at. But painting, I find it very easy. So it's kind of like if I see someone play the piano and it's incredible, I'm like, how to... do you do that? Or a business person is running 10 businesses like that. I can't organise my own lunch. So I guess we all have strengths.
When you're painting, Vincent, what's your state of mind like? You know, are you really focused, or is it kind of wide open? What's it feel like?
So I should explain. Listening to me talk is like watching TV and someone keeps flicking the channels. hard to follow. And I was thinking about the other question. What was the question?
What's happening in your brain when you're painting?
This, what I'm doing. So I can paint. I can listen to an audiobook at the same time. And when I listen to the book, I'm visualizing. It's really amazing in my head. It's like watching a film. I can see the lighting, the camera angles. I can see dust falling. I can feel like I can smell it. And I can paint at the same time and talk on the phone and listen to music. It's very strange. It's when I paint it's kind of my mind opens up.
You say that the ability to paint, to draw is something that just comes easily to you. Tell me about your cousin Enzo, who first encouraged you in drawing.
My dad had a shop in Thornbury. Next door was my uncle's shop, his brother. All the cousins would be there and they were all up to something wrong. Enzo would be in his dad's cake shop and he would make me lunch. He was the big brotherly kind of figure I didn't really have. And he started to teach me how to draw comics like Batman and Spider-Man. I just fell in love with it.
Your dad was part of a big Italian family. How did he first meet your mum? Where were they?
They actually met at an immigration camp in Broadmeadows.
Your mum's family were Irish, though she'd been raised in Birmingham. And after your mum and dad got together, they went back and spent some time living in Birmingham, which is where you were born. And then you came back to Melbourne. How many people might have been living in your house at one time?
Oh, sometimes. I remember, we moved house maybe, you know, especially once my parents had broke up. It would be 30, 40 times. Like, it was moving. We were kind of, I guess, homeless in a way because, you know, our home was only our home until they realised we couldn't pay for it, and then we got evicted and found the next one and did the same thing. And we got pretty good at it. But I remember earlier it would be us five kids, my parents, my grandparents, my auntie, her four kids, and another cousin. And a Shetland pony in the backyard.
A Shetland pony?
Yeah. My family are, like, let's say eccentric. And is hoarding the right word? There's a lot of shit, you know, plus a lot of people.
What did it smell like inside that house?
It smelt good on Sunday when my dad was cooking. He did that, you know, now and again when I was a small kid. We also had probably two dogs and about three cats. And it smelled like a very full household.
What about cigarette smoke?
My dad's car was like an ashtray, like seriously like an ashtray. You know when you see, you don't empty the ashtray, it just overfills and then it goes onto the carpet. And we must have went to school smelling like cigarettes. I remember we would all be piled, too many people in the car, and I just remember this moment, and the doors open and my friend said, I thought your car was on fire, because it was like a magic trick, you know, smoke bomb, and then five kids fall out.
Who was in charge at home?
No one was in charge, and that, I think that was part of the problem. There was a fear of my dad, but he wasn't there often, big fear, and pretty much there were no boundaries.
You say you were scared of your dad. What else were you afraid of as a little kid?
I was just afraid of the whole world. I was probably very afraid that people would find out I was stupid. That's what I thought I was, you know, couldn't read and write. But it's not just reading and writing and maths and all of that stuff. It's a way of thinking that's very different that no one else had and I couldn't explain to anyone. Just, yeah, fear that I was very different and people would find out. Also, it was a very violent neighbourhood. Strangely, I'm not afraid of much. You know? I jump off high things. I can drive fast, ride a motorbike. It's a risky business, no problem. It was my fear was more those things, you know, the things close to me.
For kids who have really chaotic home lives, school can sometimes be this safe place, like a refuge, but it doesn't sound like school had that role for you.
Yeah. I made myself popular at school, so no one would kind of know. And school was not in any way a happy place. Like, I remember trying to make myself sick as often as I could. I would be the class clown to get kicked out. Rather, you know, I was looking for confidence, and I found confidence in, you know, making people laugh and getting kicked out. And that was like, cool, now I'm outside. I'm not going to be embarrassed when the teacher says it's T-H-th, not th. I couldn't speak properly either. It's like, then on top of that, I found confidence in being bad. So never a bully, but, you know, I would get into fights every single day. I think about kids now. I hear parents saying, the school's calling me up and, you know, my kid's in, you know, some kids picking on them. There's a story behind that kid and why they're doing it.
You were really struggling with dyslexia at the time. Were any teachers picking up on that, helping you with that?
Yeah, it really baffles me. Like, I just don't understand. I never wrote anything down that would have made sense. I couldn't copy off the board. I never ever read a book. I didn't pass one class my whole life, and no one said anything. They just thought I didn't want to do it. And maybe I was very convincing. Never read a book at home. I hated books. They were the enemy.
So you just kept being moved up the year levels, even though you were facing these kind of challenges. Yep.
They did know, but no one had a, you know, I don't want to sound like a big sook, you know, because I know lots of people have hard lives as a kid, but I was put in a special class with deaf kid, blind kid, wheelchair kid, the autistic kid, myself, and then you would go out at lunchtime and kids would say, oh, dummy, you're in a special class, you're a retard, and then I would flip. My response to conflict most of my life until I was an adult was violence.
Tell me about that outside of school, out on the streets. What kind of fighter were you there?
I had a very good awareness, like a emotional and social awareness, that I knew that probably because I knew how to hide, I also knew if I was to act crazy enough, the fight's almost won. No one wants to fight a savage dog. And I would, like, pull my hair, I'd punch myself in the face. You know, I would, like, but it kind of, it was real. Like, it makes my hair stand up. I would use a bottle, a knife, a bat. I just knew, I knew how to win the fight by cheating but not cheating, like everything else in my life.
Were you always on the ready, like always on high alert when you were outside?
You know, it's, I've lived in total fear. You know, I developed this reputation, and it's kind of funny, like you look at me, I'm not, you know, not some massive, muscly guy, but I developed this reputation and then I had to keep it. And I would have carloads of guys coming down from, you know, I was 14 and I had carloads of guys from different neighbourhoods, you know, the different nationalities. Are the Filipinos today, it's the Turks another day. And I was at a train station. These guys came down, it's five of them, one very big one. And I knew they were coming for me. People warned me. And I'm like, okay, everyone's watching. I can't, you know, pussy out of this situation, wrong word. Cops were down the street. So I moved closer to the police. Not so they could save me, but so I could manipulate and win the fight. So moved closer to them. I knew that police will break the fight up. So if I run in, fly kick this guy, start biting him, smashing him, like acting like the crazy kid, everyone would say he went and fought these five guys and it got broken up. But I knew if it wasn't for the police breaking it up, I would have got smashed. So, like, kids shouldn't have to think like that, you know? Like, I was, I couldn't sleep at night. I had people calling my house, making threats. It's just, it was, I feel like I didn't get to be a kid.
Tell me about the Marco Polo gym at Essendon.
Marco Polo gym. So I was at a mate's place, not my suburb. We were walking around the streets, walked past this house that was actually a gym, and it was Jack Rennie's gym. Jack Rennie was a world-famous boxing coach who had a gym in a backyard, trained Lionel Rose and Johnny Famagon, and I just thought, this is like TV. And I went in there, and it was like a magical moment. I fell in love, like, you know, with boxing. The stinky smell of it, all these guys in there. I was already fighting every day, and this was like, okay, you get to do this, and it's a sport.
What kind of man was Jack Rennie to you?
Again, it makes me emotional because I think some reason Jack wanted to help youth that were in trouble, but he had a very special way of doing it by not making them feel threatened or they're going to lose their place. But he did say to me, it's the first time in my life someone set boundaries. And, you know, that's what makes me emotional because he said through school, how did I get away with all that? And then someone notices you and they kind of set these boundaries. And he said, if you want to train here, you can train for free. I had no money. That was big to me. And he said, but if you get in fights, if you do drugs, you know, he said, if you're defending yourself and you have no choice, I get it, common sense. But if you're going to fuck around and be that kid, you're not part of this gym. And I mostly listened to him.
And did you show him that talent you had as an artist?
Well, first, I thought I was a very good boxer and, you know, I was winning some titles. I hadn't lost a fight. It was, you know, I loved it. It was the first time that I was good at something. I wanted to thank Jack, so I did a little sketch for him of Lionel Rose and Johnny Famagon, and kind of insulting, but he said, you might be better at drawing or art than boxing. I was like, thanks very much. And, yeah, so he asked me to do another, that was a sketch, he asked me to do a painting, and then he used the painting to make prints. We got Lionel Rose and Johnny Famagon to sign them. We raised some money for the Boxing Hall of Fame, and I got paid, and it was the first time I got paid for something I was good at, and it was just, yeah, life-changing.
So you found this real place that was affirming to you of who you were and encouraged you and this mentor figure, and you fell in love with the sport of boxing. Tell me, what's the secret to training with a floor-to-ceiling ball?
It has like a round ball, like the size of a basketball in the middle or smaller, and a string to the roof and to the floor. And it's all about your reflexes. So you can become a good boxer with nothing else but that. It's timing and movement, it's rhythm. It's probably the reason I can dance so well. I did it for hours and I got very good.
So you'd met Jack and he had really wanted you to stay on the right side of the law. But when it came to making money, Vince, you were around crime really right from the start. Tell me about the Italian restaurant you worked at in Brunswick.
You're right. When you're in thick of it, you don't know any better. I had a few restaurants. All of them were dodgy. But then this one in particular is kind of interesting because I don't know if you've seen the Simpsons episode where Bart goes to work for the mafia. It was exactly like that. I watched the episode and I'm like, oh, my God. Like, he goes in there and there's all these bosses. There was a secret casino at the back. You would even get police in there, ambulance drivers, mafia bosses, the fruiterers. They were all in there, construction guys and all gambling. And I walked in there and they're like, hey, I could cook. I couldn't read the menu, but I could cook them all a good pasta. So they loved me and I had a nickname. They had nicknames, Nick the Knife, you know, like those kind of things. This is Spider. And I was junior. Probably not a great place. They were dealing drugs. I was helping them, but I felt at home.
You were nearly sent to jail when you just turned 20. What had happened?
Well, I was nearly sent to jail a number of times. And, you know, if I got caught for the things I did, I would probably still be in jail now. I don't know how. I'm so grateful. I'm ashamed of things I did. And when I say things I did, again, I don't want people to think I was like a bully and I never did anything like that. But I was a bit ruthless in defending myself. And this particular time, my brother got jumped at a party, my younger brother, 5 years younger, by guys that were older than me, and I was just furious. And I took my brother in my car, and I really, like, I don't know how, what I was thinking. I stalked them. I stalked their house. I was like this, you know, I thought I was Batman. And they left the house in a car, a couple of them, and I followed them. It was on, like, a main road with a tram, and I ran them off the road, and I jumped out the car thinking I was like a cop, like, what's your name? Show me your ID. I wanted to make sure it was the right guy. Anyway, it was. And I just let loose on both of them in a, like, how dumb, how wrong. But I grew up, the police were the enemy, rich people were the enemy. And you just, you don't talk, you don't dob, you handle things yourself. And that's what I did. I messed them up pretty good. In the middle of a main road with everyone watching and a tram dinging, and the police came and arrested me, and I ended up being caught, and I was already in trouble. I was already doing like community service or something else. I just, you know, you think you're invincible, or you know there's a consequence, you just don't care. I just didn't care, you know. And I'm sitting in court and I'm screwed. So the judge gets up and he says, for this, blah, 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 all the different charges, you could do a minimum of 5 years or a maximum of blah, blah, blah. And I didn't realise that I could go to jail. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm not going to go home. There was, I don't think I had anyone in the court, and I had this dumbass court-appointed lawyer. He couldn't care less, I felt. It just so happens that I got a reference from my uncle, who's a doctor. Didn't even know him well, actually, but he's a surgeon. And it just so happens that he saved the judge's wife's life.
What?
In surgery. And I saw the judge read the letter, and I just saw him like, you know, like something happened. I was like, oh. And he said, I know Dr. Jamieson, didn't tell anyone in the court how he knew. He said, I know Dr. Jamieson, and if he says you deserve a second chance, I'm giving it to you. But you have to understand, blah, 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 suspended sentence, community service, and the cop's jaw just dropped. But I thought to myself, I mean, pretty fucking lucky, and I thought, I can't do this again. And I kind of, I did. But I knew it was definitely a fork in the road where I said I could go to jail if I head down this road. And I tried my very best to go in a different direction. So if I was going in a different direction, at least I had the conscience, where before it was just, who cares?
The direction that you wanted to go in was art, but it must have felt like a completely foreign world to you. I mean, did you go to art galleries ever as a kid or a teenager?
I hadn't even been to a museum. I even failed art class. So drawing is something I would do on the street, graffiti. It's something I would draw caricatures that make my friends laugh in class. And I knew that there were artists. I didn't even know who. And what I did know is that artists make money when they're dead. And so for me, it wasn't a way of getting out. I'd be better off, you know, you think, oh, well, I can't do anything. I can't even get a job in a factory. I failed those tests. And, you know, what am I going to do, be a drug dealer? Because being an artist, it's still a real problem. Like, you tell someone you're an artist and they say, what else do you do? You know, and if you make too much money, you're a sellout. So, but I want, my mission is to change that, to make kids who need a way out see art as an opportunity, not be afraid that you don't have to lose your integrity in what you do because you want to look after your kids.
It took you a few goes, but you did get into art school. The fact that you couldn't read or write properly, that you'd never been taught properly given your dyslexia, how on earth did you get through exams and assignments?
Well, it did take me a couple of goes to get in, and I lied to get in. And when I did, I'm like, oh, you know, all I wanted was to have a piece of paper that said I finished something. And I was so determined. I worked day and night. I lived in my studio practically, practical work. And I got high distinctions for that. So I cheat on every exam.
By getting other people.
Yeah. So I was able to make money at that time by painting little portraits, not a lot of money, but enough to pay other students. You know, sometimes flirt with someone to help me write my whole essay. You know, and all that stuff makes you feel like shit because I don't want to be manipulative and I don't want to lie. So my last essay of the last year of my course, and I paid this guy to do the essay. He always got good marks, but he plagiarized mine. And again, my fault, but I got called in to an office. There's the head of art school, the history teacher that was like, you know, some people are just mean. She was mean. Like, my mind hasn't changed on that one. So they said this essay, they put it in front of me. This is plagiarized. What do you have to say? So very quickly, I think ADHD, dyslexic people can think very quickly. It's like slow motion. Okay, what am I going to do? Tell them I plagiarised, tell them I paid someone and they plagiarised, or the, you know, the worst, the thing that I'm most scared of, that I've been scared of since I was a kid, and that's, you know, I'm stupid. And I knew the dumb word, dyslexia, I mean, silly word, like, why make it hard to spell? Couldn't look it up. I didn't even know how to use a computer or any of that business. So I said, I think I'm dyslexic, not really knowing what it is. She said, oh, so this means that you cheated on every essay. You're going to have to do 3 years of history. She was determined to push it. So not that this guy's telling, you know, the truth.
So had you ever told anyone before that explicitly?
No, not one person.
You couldn't read or write?
So I couldn't say it again, Mr. Emotional. I couldn't say it. Hard to say it now. You know, I was this tough kid that was crying in front of these adults, one bully, one very special guy. He was one of the guys that would, you know, talk the art language, but he also knew the human language. And he said, all right, well, if you can prove you're dyslexic, I'll work with you and we'll see what we can do.
After years of desperately trying to hide your inability to read and write, you came clean in your final year at art school after you were sprung for cheating on an essay. What happened next?
I went and did this test. So for the first time I passed the test. It was good, 100%. And now I have to face that, not stupid, I have a disability. So it was really, like, it made things make sense. I didn't know about dyslexia. I just thought, okay, that means that I actually can't learn. I couldn't have done that job. I can't, you know, I didn't know the alphabet. I still don't. I don't even know the months of the year or, you know, someone says left, I go right. Months, north, south, east, west, any of that business, I don't know it. My cousins' names or my nieces or nephews, my kids' date of birth, it's that bad. It's not just about reading. Where was I? And I also forget what I'm talking about.
So you had acknowledged this and then you get, I mean, it doesn't sound like it was anything as simple as just a relief to get that diagnosis.
So RMIT were amazing. I can say I'm now a professor from the university. They gave that to me. I did the graduate speech in front of, you know, 45,000 people. They've been incredible, really. So there is, I don't want people to think it's all gloomy. But I felt like a loser. I'm never going to learn. Now I know, and I can tell other people that are going through this. People tell me, oh, I just found out my kid's been diagnosed with ADHD or dyslexia or autism. I'm like, congratulations, this is the best gift you can get. We're different. We have a superpowers. We have incredible empathy. You know, it's like being able to read minds sometimes. And you look at you look at people with all these conditions and they fill up half the prisons and they also fill up half of the most successful creative and entrepreneurs in the world, Richard Branson, Steven Spielberg. You know, there's so many incredible people, athletes, musicians, academics even, you know, because, again, dyslexia is so, and all these diversities are so broad.
So in your mid-20s, you finally get this diagnosis of dyslexia and start getting help for it? Like,
I'm very passionate about all of this stuff and I think people are diagnosed and then they're like, well, what am I going to do? So I was diagnosed. It helped in a sense of I have it as an excuse, but no solutions. There are things you can do, like processes to make things easy. But I think what a lot of parents and sometimes teachers and or even, you know, husbands and wives don't understand is that kid's not going to be good at that. So you've got to find something they are good at and they'll be exceptional at it, like next level. So, again, my boxing, I remember in between rounds, I was fighting this guy and I was losing the first round. He was a very tough buffhead and he was like a slugger. So competitive me thinks I can slug back at him, and that's not the way I fight. I like to not get hit. So Jack said, if you want to win, you need to fight your own fight. Do what you're good at, and he's not as good at it. And that, it's funny, you know, a sentence in life somewhere can change everything. So Did I get help? No. But what I realised is I'm not going to be able to do those things, so I'm going to find the stuff I'm good at and just do that. So I helped myself.
You were also, in your mid-20s, super ambitious. You knew that you wanted a different sort of life than the one that seemed to be on offer, but it wasn't yet clear how you were going to make a living out of art, so you had one more fairly major criminal venture in mind. Tell me about the business that you started.
I didn't even, you know, I didn't do drugs because I thought I was an athlete. And, you know, my mates would steal a car and I would stand outside skipping while they were doing bongs in the car. But I thought, okay, it's not that bad, you know, I'll grow some plants. Not being able to fill a form out, somehow, I think I just got other people and hustled, I rented a house myself, 4-bedroom house. I figured out how to steal the electricity from different houses, and I had some money from painting, and I thought, oh, I'll invest it. I was investing. I'm a businessman. And I bought all these hydroponic lights and this whole setup. It was actually like, you know, it worked, and I couldn't believe it. Every room in the house was jam-packed with these big, thick, juicy marijuana plants. The problem was I wasn't living there, and I invited my brother. I have to say, my very good brother, that I spent my whole life protecting. We didn't have a dad, so I thought I was that, you know, I didn't even let him swear. You know, I made him go to school, cook dinner. Like, I love my brother so much, and I invited him in there to live there and kind of look after the plants. I was the drug dealer, not him. So I sold all the plants. I was making lots of money. We're doing second, third, fourth round of plants. And my dad, who I hadn't seen for many years, came back from wherever he was, and we met him for a coffee, I did, and I told him what I was doing, hoping for, you know, again, I chased the boundaries my whole life. I wanted him to give a fuck about me, and so I said, oh, I'll try this one. I'll tell him what I'm doing. I'm a drug dealer, Dad. And he goes, oh, well, how do I get in on this? And just like, I felt, again, like the kid that no one gave a fuck about, no one noticed. The worst rejection in the world is the rejection from the person that's meant to love you the most.
Did you want him to say stop?
I wanted him to say, what the fuck are you doing? Are you serious? You can go to jail. And he said, oh, cut me in. Can you give me the money to do my setup and then I'll grow them and you sell them? I'm like, Jesus. And then I thought, it just went off. And I'm like, fuck, this is what I've done to my brother. And it's one of the biggest regrets in my whole life, that I feel like I tainted him the way I was tainted. I broke something innocent about our bond. And anyway, good news. Next day, ripped it up and it was done. I wouldn't do something like
that.
I just shut it off completely. I threw all the stuff out, threw the plants out and broke my lease. You know, I was done. But the guilt never leaves me. And I have to apologise to him now.
So after that interaction with your dad, you stopped that business and you really put your energies into art. Mm-hmm. And your art career began to take off. And it became supercharged by the portrait of your friend, the late actor Heath Ledger, which won the People's Choice Award at the 2008 Archibald Prize. That must have felt such a bittersweet way to get that success.
There's no other way of describing it. Like, the last words Heath said to me was, this painting's going to change our lives. It's kind of like he knew something. But when I say that, he was very ambitious, he was very complicated, and he was going through a very complicated time. He's also so in love with his daughter and very ambitious about his future. Because of his words, I think, I painted, like, you know, obsessively for 3 weeks. And on the end of that 3 weeks, I was at, you know, I had the painting next to my television, I was painting all night in my apartment. Turn on TV, I emailed the picture to him the night before. Turn on TV and Heath has passed. And, you know, just, you know, shock. Like, I didn't even believe it. And then I had, like, all of a sudden, I'm relevant, and I have all these people ringing my bell from newspapers, camera people outside. Everyone knew I was doing this portrait, and now everyone wants to see it. It's on the front cover of the newspapers. I didn't know what to do. I heard in my mind, he's saying, well, here's your chance. Don't fuck it up. You know that this is why we did it, so don't stop. I knew that, but at the same time, other people don't know that I knew that or thought that, and I didn't want to look like I'm taking advantage of this. I got in contact with Kim, or he got in contact with me. I don't quite remember, but...
This is his dad.
Yes. And he said it's okay, because he knows what Heath would have wanted, and that's why it was okay. His mum said it was okay. I checked with everyone, and all of a sudden, I'm a famous artist, and my friend's dead.
He was right that portrait would change your life. It did that in many ways.
So many.
Tell me about who you met at a bar the night of the awards ceremony.
You know, it really was, like, when you say it like that, because I haven't had that thought of that path, he gave me so many friends. I feel like he even gave me my family now, because it all came from this moment. I was doing all right as an artist anyway, selling my exhibitions, but not like this. I had a friend, Michael Gracie, who is now a very famous director, Greatest Showman, and the Robbie Williams one he just did. He took me to a bar to meet a mate that he used to work for. I had no idea, like usual. And it was kind of my moment. I'm out at this bar celebrating, and this guy has no idea who I am, and he's talking like the uppity wanker from the art world. I didn't know he was. No, he's not. He's actually exceptional. And anyway, he was doing the talk, and I was like, fuck you, because I'm an artist now, and who do you think you are? I don't have to be scared of these people. He stands up, and I stand up, and we're having this stupid argument. Everyone's watching us, and we just realize at the same time, we burst out laughing, and that was the start of my Baz Luhrmann adventures. It was pretty funny. I talk like I have Tourette's, and he talks like he's the Riddler from Batman. I mean, you should see our text messages. It's the odd couple.
What adventure did the two of you end up on in India, riding motorbikes together?
Oh, so I'd had a trip to India, and I had a little mini exhibition. That's a whole other story. And they invited me back to have a proper exhibition. I told Baz, and he was in between films, his eyes lit up, doesn't know how to ride a motorbike, but says, yeah, I'm in. And I'm like, okay, can't ride a motorbike. He went and got his license, and we spent like a month riding Royal Enfields around India. They wanted me to advertise Royal Enfield.
What's it like to ride a motorbike in India?
It's insane. Like, you dodge people on the road. You know, there's chickens, there's cows, elephants. It's absolute madness, no rules. There's just a horn constantly going. So Baz said, I can't just go. We'll raise money for a charity. The India friends that I had wanted us to raise money for hearing impaired kids. It was just incredible. These kids were amazing. We went through all different villages around India. We took photographs, had an exhibition, painted murals. It was like, it's fairy tale, like it can never happen again because our lives. And Baz, riding motorbikes in India, we're riding back, very last bit, and we didn't realise when buses slow down, people jump off before the bus stops. I'm riding in front, and I look back, and there's no Baz. I rode back 2 kilometres, I hadn't noticed. There's Baz on the side of the road with a busted bike, and someone jumped out of the bus on top of Baz. The guy, I think, broke his leg. Baz smashed his hand up very bravely. Well, he jumped on my bike, and I rode his crooked bike back, but for someone that only got their license a few weeks before, is
brave, crazy. I don't know. Yeah, there's one adjective.
But that's him. He's crazy and brave. That's the good description.
Did you get to keep those motorbikes?
They gave us new ones, and they sent them back to Australia. Not Baz's crooked one, but he's kept the memory. We had to go to hospital.
Do you still ride together now?
I don't think Baz rides so much anymore. I ride every day. Like, bikes are a big part of my life.
There's a photo in your memoir, Vince, of you and your wife, Asha Keddie, which was taken the first day that you met. And it doesn't look like a photo of two people who've just met. It looks like a couple who've just emerged sort of blissfully from the bedroom. What was going on?
I like that, from the bedroom. No. There's so many things that happen in my life that are like complicated. These are good things. I was single dadding, and as most people know, I can't even organise my own lunch. It was very difficult. And I was having an exhibition. I was painting 30 portraits in 30 days. It was a project that Heath and I came up with. He passed, couldn't do it. I did it in Hong Kong, then I did it in New York with one of Heath's mates. I was doing it in Melbourne. In New York and Hong Kong, the project was meet this person, they tell you who to paint next, and it snowballs. In Melbourne, I kind of know people, so it was, you know, inspirational people. And Matt Moran, my mate, who I also met at a bar in Sydney after an Archibald, painted Matt, and he suggested Asher. I have no idea who Asher is. I don't watch TV and no clue. I did know she. I Googled her and she's good looking. Her agent knew of me, and it's not something Asher would, knowing Asher so well, she would not give her time. She would like, no, she's focused. But she did, because her agent, now a good friend, forced her to go. She's waiting outside reluctantly in her car. Like, I can picture it now. I know her. She's fuming. And I'm got someone to look after Luca, clean my studio, wheeling out bins, looking like an absolute mess, covered in paint, two wheelie bins in my hand. I saw her. I think I dropped the bins. And she looked at me, and that was it. And then I think she went home with me that... No, she'd kill me for saying...
But it was an instant connection.
It was an instant connection. And funny, like, I did her photo, and I wasn't looking through the lens. I just couldn't stop looking at her. And I was so determined to impress her. I think I did the whole portrait in about 3 hours and texted to her, like, yeah, magic trick. And she was impressed, and now she's stuck with me. I'm not allowed to paint any more hot actresses unless she's there.
This new partner of yours was a really big deal. You didn't know about her, but she was starring in this hit show in Offspring when you met. She's a Logie Award winner year after year after year. What was it like to start a relationship in the glare of that kind of fame?
So I already knew quite a few famous people, you know, Baz and Matt and Heath and all those things. I knew about the world, but it was never my world. And my world was definitely not her world. She was living quite blissfully in the country with her horses, and I was living my mad, chaotic life. And she just dived right in. And yes, pretty amazing. It's very hard to be a step parent. And, you know, Luca's got his mum too, that they love each other a lot, and then you're a step-parent, and I appreciate it. Like, it was, again, someone I love, all the things I love about Asher. She doesn't take any shit. She's very clever. She's a leader. She makes her own choices. We disagree on a lot. I'm right, she's wrong. But, she, you know, I like that we challenge each other. Yeah. I couldn't think of any other way.
You, as you say, were already dad to Luca when you two met, and then the two of you had a much longed-for child together, Valentino. You've had this chance, Vince, to be a really different dad to your sons than your dad was to you. Is it tough doing it without a roadmap, without a model to follow?
Like to claim all the good in that, but I'm so lucky. I've had, you know, a lot of shit happen, and I've had some incredible people in my life. I had Jack Rennie and Matt and Kim and Michael Gudinski. All these people helped me, you know, that, I don't know, what's the saying, a village to raise a kid, but it was a village to
raise a dad.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, even now I have incredible friends that I definitely couldn't have done any of it without all those people.
And for you, what have you found to be the heart of being a dad? Like, what's the most important part from your experience?
The most important thing to me is that when my boys are adults and someone asks them about their dad, they're going to say, I just love him. I don't care about anything else. Like, we all make mistakes. I want to always be there for them. They will come before anything else. Always. And I tell my 15-year-old, if you ever stop hugging me and saying you love me out loud in front of people. I've never raised my voice to my kids ever. I haven't had to do that. And that's probably the time I would.
That's your threat.
What the?
You know, you first turned to boxing to get skills that you needed to help, partly in those years as a street fighter. What role does boxing have in your life these days?
Yeah, it's something really strange has happened. You know, I'm always passionate about it. I always did it. I had a good friend, Patrick, I invited to train with me. He was a CEO of Rolex at the time, never boxed in his life. Started boxing. He told one of his friends, one of his friends told another friend, I invited another friend. Every Tuesday and Thursday in my studio, 7 to 8 in the morning, I have the most incredible, eclectic group of people, like CEOs of big, big companies, plastic surgeons, musicians, film directors, dads from soccer, you know, the plumber, and their lives are big. They're very busy and very full. And we all find this time twice a week. And it's really, they all suck at boxing. No. they're all very passionate and they're learning something new. It's not about that. We put on cheesy music and we're sweating and we're not at a pub. And it's really the most amazing mental health kind of group. And I think it's changed my life. And it's definitely changed a lot of the others' lives. It's, you know, people, really important people are coming up to me like at the Grand Prix, I hear about this boxing group, or how do we get in? I'm like, I'll speak to the board. You know,
is there a waiting list?
There would be. We don't talk about it because it might explode. But it's that special. It's like, I don't know, it's really magical. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get to become a professional boxer, but this is like so good.
When you talk about your life, Vince, and the stories you've written about in your book, it's so clear that things could have gone such a different way for you, as it did for lots of the kids you grew up with. What do you think it was that allowed this different path for you? What do you put it down to?
I'm lucky I have a talent. I'm lucky that I'm dyslexic and ADHD and all those things. I think it gives me an advantage. That's kind of funny to say now. Also, you know, I was very vulnerable as a kid, enough that, you know, I wanted to kill myself when I was a kid. But I do know now that I probably wouldn't have. I have it's a genetic flip of a coin. Sometimes we're lucky we have mental strength and resilience, and not all people are lucky enough to have it, and I really feel for them, you know, like fall into terrible addictions. There's no rock bottom until it's too late. People can evolve. I didn't know how to hold a knife and fork. And then I learned. You learn that police aren't the enemy. We'd be screwed about them. You know, not everyone's the enemy. Money's not the enemy. I also learned, I'm going off the question, but I think it's important that we can be very like-minded, even though our experiences are very different. So I had poverty and violence. Another kid has his sexuality and parents that don't care or aren't there. He's rich, I'm poor. We're in the same shit. He has to have resilience and be able to evolve. And I think I feel I'm lucky that I believe that it doesn't have to be the same.
Yeah, when you were a little kid, because of the way the school was failing you, because of all this stuff going on at home, there were so many times where you felt afraid and you felt angry, I think, almost at yourself or despairing of yourself. But when you look back to that little kid now that you were, how do you feel towards him?
You know, I feel like, also, I think I might have the ability to look at my life like I'm watching a film. And I'm watching a film about this kid and I want to desperately help him. So it's partly why I'm doing all this and I'm talking, I'm Mr. Emotional, because I feel like that kid's still there. Now he's an adult, sometimes a kid. Sometimes a partner of that adult or parent of that kid. And if I say it, you know, I feel like I can't help him, but maybe someone else. And I think that helps me deal with it, you know, change the cycle.
I've really loved speaking with you, Vince. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thanks. Sorry I flicked through the channels.
All channels are good. They're all interesting.
It was you know, I'll call you up next time I need to chat.
The award-winning portrait painter Vincent van Tuzo was my guest on Conversations today. Vincent's memoir, written with Craig Henderson, is called Unveiled. This conversation was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Nicola Harrison is our executive producer. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.